which she had to clutch in both hands. Kappa Barsavi snapped his fingers. One of the toadies in the background vanished through a curtain.
"Then I'm not going to bore you with any more threats, Locke. This night, you're a man. You will do a man's work and suffer a man's fate if you cross your brothers and sisters. You will be one of us, one of the right people. You'll receive the words and the signs, and you'll use them discreetly. As Chains, Yogarista is sworn to me, so you are sworn to me through him. I am Yogarista above all Garistas. I am the only Duke of Camor you will ever acknowledge. Bend your knee."
Locke knelt before Barsavi. The Kappa held out his left hand, palm down. He wore an ornate ring of black pearl in a white iron setting. Nestled inside the pearl by some arcane process was a speck of red that had to be blood.
"Kiss the ring of the Kappa of Camor."
Locke did so. The pearl was cool beneath his dry lips.
"Speak the name of the man to whom you have sworn your oath."
"Kappa Barsavi,"
Locke whispered. At that moment, the Kappa's underling returned to the alcove and handed his master a small crystal tumbler filled with dull brown liquid.
"Now," said Barsavi, "as has every one of my Pezan, you will drink my toast."
From one of the pockets of his waistcoat, the Kappa drew a shark's tooth, one slightly larger than the death mark Locke wore around his neck. Barsavi dropped the tooth into the tumbler and swirled it around a few times. He then handed the tumbler to Locke.
"It's dark sugar rum from the Sea of Brass. Drink the entire thing, including the tooth. But don't swallow the tooth, whatever you do. Keep it in your mouth. Draw it out after all the liquor is gone. And try not to cut yourself."
Locke's nose smarted from the stinging aroma of hard liquor that wafted from the tumbler, and his stomach lurched, but he ground his jaws together and stared down at the slightly distorted shape of the tooth within the rum. Silently praying to his new benefactor to save him from embarrassment, he dashed the contents of the glass into his mouth, tooth and all. Swallowing was not as easy as he'd hoped. He held the tooth against the roof of his mouth with his tongue, gingerly, feeling its sharp points scrape against the back of his upper front teeth. The liquor burned. He began to swallow in small gulps that soon turned into wheezing coughs. After a few interminable seconds, he shuddered and sucked down the last of the rum, relieved that he had held the tooth carefully in place. It twisted in his mouth. Twisted physically, as though wrenched by an unseen hand, and scored a burning slash across the inside of his left cheek. Locke cried out, coughed, and spat up the tooth. It lay there in his open palm, flecked with spit and blood.
"Ah,"
said Kappa Barsavi, as he plucked the tooth up and slipped it back into his waistcoat, blood and all.
"So you see, you are bound by an oath of blood to my service. My tooth has tasted of your life, and your life is mine. So let us not be strangers, Locke Lamora. Let us be Kappa and Pezan, as the Crooked Warden intended."
At a gesture from Barsavi, Locke stumbled to his feet, already inwardly cursing the now familiar sensation of liquor rapidly going to his head. His stomach was empty from the day's hangover. The room was already swaying a bit around him. When he set eyes on Nazca once again, he saw that she was smiling at him above her ale-jack, with the air of smarmy tolerance the older children in Shades Hill had once shown to him and his compatriots in streets. Before he knew what he was doing, Locke bent his knee to her as well.
"If you're the next Kappa Barsavi," he said rapidly, "I should swear to serve you too. I do, Madam, Madam Nazca. I mean, Madam Barsavi."
The girl took a step back.
"I already have servants, boy. I have assassins. My father has 100 gangs and 2,000 knives."
"Nazca Bellona Genovese Angelise de Borsavi," her father thundered. "Now it seems you only grasp the value of strong men as servants. In time you will come to see the value of gracious ones as well. You shame me."
Nonplussed, the girl glanced back and forth between Locke and her father several times. Her cheeks slowly turned red. After a few more moments of pouting consideration, she stiffly held out her ale-jack to Locke.
"You may have some of my beer."
Locke responded as though this were the deepest honor ever conferred upon him, realizing, though hardly in so many words, all the while that the liquor was somehow running a sort of rump parliament in his brain that had overruled his usual cautious social interactions, especially with girls. Her beer was bitter, dark stuff, slightly salted. She drank like a Ferrari. Locke took two sips to be polite, then handed it back to her, bowing in a rather noodle-necked fashion as he did so. She was too flustered to say anything in return, so she merely nodded.
"Ha! Excellent!"
Kappa Barsavi chomped on his slender cigar in mirth.
"Your first peasant! Of course, both of your brothers are going to want some just as soon as they hear about this."
5. The trip home was a muggy, misty blur to Locke. He clung to the neck of his gentled goat while chains led them back north toward the Temple District, frequently cackling to himself.
"Oh, my boy," he muttered, "my dear, dear, charming sot of a boy. It was all bullshit, you realize."
"What?"
"The shark's tooth. Kappa Barsavi had a bondsmage enchant that thing for him in Carthane years ago. Nobody can swallow it without cutting themselves. He's been carrying it around ever since. All those years he spent studying Throne Therin Theatre have given him a substantial fetish for the dramatic."
"So it wasn't, like, fate or the gods or anything like that?"
"It was just a shark's tooth with a tiny bit of sorcery. A good trick, I have to admit."
Chains rubbed his own cheek in sympathy and remembrance.
"No, Locke, you don't belong to Barsavi. He's good enough for what he is, a powerful ally to have on your side, and a man that you must appear to obey at all times, but he certainly doesn't own you. In the end, neither do I."
"So I don't have to..."
"Obey the secret peace, be a good little peasant. Only for pretend, Locke. Only to keep the wolves from the door. Unless your eyes and ears have been stitched shut with rawhide these past 2 days, by now you must have realized that I intend you and Carlo and Galdo and Sabatha to be nothing less," Chains confided through a feral grin, "than a fucking ballista bolt right through the heart of Vencarlo's precious secret peace."
Part 2. Complication. I can add colors to the chameleon, change shapes with Proteus for advantages, and set the murderous Machiavel to school. King Henry VI, Part 3. Chapter 4. At the Court of Kappa Barsavi. 1.
19,000, said Bug. 920. That's all of it. Can I please kill myself now?
What? I'd have thought you'd be enthusiastic about helping us tally the loot, Bug. Jean sat cross-legged in the middle of the dining area in the glass cellar beneath the house of Perelandro. The table and chairs had been moved away to make room for a vast quantity of gold coins, stacked into little glittering mounds that circled Jean and Bug, nearly walling them in completely.
"You didn't tell me you'd be hauling it home in tirins."
"Well, white iron is dear. Nobody's going to hand out 5,000 crowns in it, and nobody's going to be dumb enough to carry it around like that. Moraggio's makes all of its big payouts in tirins." There was a rattling noise from the entrance passage to the cellar. Then Locke appeared around the corner, dressed as Lucas Fairwhite. He whipped his false optics off, loosened his cravats and shrugged out of his wool coat, letting it fall unceremoniously to the floor. His face was flushed, and he was waving a piece of folded parchment affixed with a blue wax seal.
7,500 more, my boys! I told him we'd found 4 likely galleons, but that we were already having cash flow problems. Bribes to be paid, crews to be called back and sobered up, officers to be placated, other cargo shippers to be chased off. And he just handed it right over, smiling all the while. Gods, I should have thought this scam up 5 years ago. We don't even have to bother setting up fake ships and paperwork and so forth, because Salvara knows the Fairwhite part of the game is a lie. There's nothing for us to do except relax and count the money.
If it's so relaxing, why don't you count it then?
Bug jumped to his feet and leaned backward until his back and his neck made a series of little popping noises.
I'd be happy to, Bug.
Locke took a bottle of red wine out of a wooden cupboard and poured himself half a glass, then watered it from a brass pitcher of lukewarm rainwater until it was a soft pink.
And tomorrow you can play Lucas Fairwhite. I'm sure Don Salvara would never notice any difference. Is it all here?
5,000 crowns delivered as 20,000 tyrins, said Jean. Less 80 for clerking fees and guards and a rented dray to haul it from Miragio's. The gentleman bastards used a simple substitution scheme for hauling large quantities of valuables to their hideout at the House of Perelandro. At a series of quick stops, strong boxes of coins would vanish from one wagon and barrels marked as common food or drink would roll off on another. Even a decrepit little temple needed a steady infusion of basic supplies.
"Well," said Locke, "let me get rid of poor Master Fairwhite's clothes and I'll give you a hand dumping it all in the vault."
There were actually 3 vaults tucked away at the rear of the cellar, behind the sleeping quarters. 2 of them were wide elderglass-coated shafts that went down about 10 feet. Their original purpose was unknown. With simple wooden doors mounted on hinges set atop them, they resembled nothing so much as miniature grain storage towers sunk into the earth and filled to a substantial depth with coins of every sort. Silver and gold in large quantities went into the vaults. Narrow wooden shelves around the periphery of the vault room held small bags or piles of more readily useful currency. There were cheap purses of copper barons, fine leather wallets with tight rolls of silver solons, and small bowls of clipped half-copper bits, all of them set out for the rapid taking for any scam or need one of the gang might face. There were even little stacks of foreign coinage, marks from the Kingdom of the Seven Marrows, solari from Tal Verar, and so forth. Even back in the days of Father Chains, there had been no locks on these vaults or on the room that held them. This was not merely because the gentlemen bastards trusted one another, and they did, nor because the existence of their luxurious cellar was a closely guarded secret, and it certainly was. The primary reason was one of practicality. Not one of them, Carlo or Galdo or Locke or Jean or Bug, had anything they could conceivably do with their steadily growing pile of precious metal. Outside of Kappa Barsavi, they had to be the wealthiest thieves in Camor. The little parchment ledger set aside on one of the shelves would list more than 43,000 full crowns when Don Salvara's second note was turned into cold coin. They were as wealthy as the man they were currently robbing, and far wealthier than many of his peers. Yet, so far as anyone knew, the gentlemen bastards were an unassuming gang of ordinary sneak thieves, competent and discreet enough, steady earners, but hardly shooting stars. They could live comfortably for 10 crowns apiece each year, and to spend much more than that would invite the most unwelcome scrutiny imaginable, from every authority in Camor, legal or otherwise. In 4 years, they'd brought off 3 huge scores, and were currently working on their 4th. For 4 years, the vast majority of the money had simply been counted and thrown down into the darkness of the vaults. The truth was, Chains had trained them superbly for the task of relieving Camor's nobility of the burden of some of its accumulated wealth, but had perhaps neglected to discuss the possible uses of the sums involved. Other than financing further theft, the gentleman bastards really had no idea what they were eventually going to do with it all. Their tithe to Kappa Barsavi averaged about a crown a week. 2.
"Rejoice!"
cried Carlo as he appeared in the kitchen, just as Locke and Jean were moving the dining table back to its customary position.
"The Sansa brothers are returned!"
"I do wonder," said Jean, "if that particular combination of words has ever been uttered by anyone before now."
"Only in the chambers of unattached young ladies across the city," said Galdo, as he set a small burlap sack down on the table.
Locke shook it open and perused the contents. A few lockets set with semi-precious stones, a set of moderately well-crafted silver forks and knives, and an assortment of rings ranging from cheap engraved copper to one made of threaded gold and platinum, set with flecks of obsidian and diamond.
"Oh, very nice," said Locke. "Very likely. Jean, would you pick out a few more bits from the bullshit box and get me 20 solons, right?"
20's good and proper." While Locke gestured for Carlo and Galdo to help him set chairs back in place around the dining table, Jean walked back to the vault room, where there was a tall, narrow wooden chest tucked against the left-hand wall. He threw back the lid on its creaky hinges and began rummaging inside, a thoughtful expression on his face. The bullshit box was filled to a depth of about 2 feet with a glittering pile of jewelry, knick-knacks, household items, and decorative gewgaws. There were crystal statues, mirrors in carved ivory frames, necklaces and rings, candle holders in 5 kinds of precious metal. There were even a few bottles of drugs and alchemical draughts, wrapped in felt to cushion them and marked with little paper labels. Since the gentlemen bastards could hardly tell the Kappa about the true nature of their operations, and since they had neither the time nor the inclination to actually break into houses and clamber down chimneys, the bullshit box was one of the pillars of their ongoing deception. They topped it off once or twice a year, going on buying sprees in the pawn shops and markets off Talisham or Ashmere, where they could get whatever they needed openly. They supplemented it only slightly and carefully with goods picked up in Camor, usually things stolen on a whim by the Sansas or secured by Bug as part of his continuing education. Jean selected a pair of silver wine goblets, a pair of gold-framed optics inside a fine leather case, and one of the little wrapped bottles. Clutching all of this carefully in one hand, he then counted 20 small silver coins off a shelf, kicked the bullshit box shut, and hurried back out to the dining room. Bug had rejoined the group and was ostentatiously walking a solon across the knuckles of his right hand. He'd mastered the trick only weeks previously, after long months of watching the Sansas, who could each do both hands at once, reversing directions in perfect unison.
"Let us say," said Jean, "that we have had a somewhat slothful week. Nobody expects much from second-story men when the nights are wet like this anyway. We might look out of place if we haul in too much. Surely His Honour will understand."
"Of course," said Locke. "Quite a reasonable thought."
He reached out and took the felt-wrapped bottle for close examination. His handwritten label identified it as sugared milk of opium, a rich lady's vice made from dried jeremite poppies. He removed the label and the felt, then tucked the faceted glass bottle with its brass stopper into the burlap sack. The rest of the loot followed.
"Right. Now, is there any speck of Lucas Fairwhite still clinging to me? Any make-up or mummery?"
He stuck out his arms and twirled several times. Jean and the Sansas assured him that he was entirely Locke Lamora for the moment.
"Well then, if we're all our proper selves, let's go pay our taxes."
Locke lifted the sack of stolen items and tossed it casually to Bug. The boy yelped, dropping his coin, and caught the sack with a muffled clatter of shaken metal.
"Good for my moral education, I suppose."
"No," said Locke. "This time I really am just being a lazy old bastard. At least you won't have to work the barge pole."
3. It was the third hour of the afternoon when they set out from the Temple of Perelandro via their assorted escape tunnels and side entrances. A warm drizzle was falling from the sky, which was neatly divided as though by some ruler and stylus of the gods. Low dark clouds filled the north, while the sun was just starting downward in the bright clear southwest. The pleasant scent of fresh rain on hot stone welled up everywhere, briefly washing the usual city miasmas from the air. The gentlemen bastards gathered once again at the southwestern docks of the temple district, where they hailed a gondola for hire. The boat was long and shallow and heavily weathered, with a freshly killed rat lashed to the bow spar just beneath a small wooden idol of Iono. This was allegedly a peerless ward against capsizing and other misfortunes. The pole man perched at the stern like a parrot in his red and orange striped cotton jacket, protected from the rain by a broad-brimmed straw hat that drooped out past his skinny shoulders. He turned out to be a canal jumper and purse cutter of their acquaintance, Nervous Vitale Vento of the Grey Faces gang. Vitale rigged a mildewy leather umbrella to keep some of the drizzle off his passengers, and then began to pole them smoothly east between the high stone banks of the temple district and the overgrown lushness of the Mara Camorazza. The Mara had once been a garden maze for a rich governor of the Therin throne era. Now it was largely abandoned by the city watch and haunted by cutpurses. The only reason honest folk even ventured into its dangerous green passages was that it was the heart of a network of footbridges connecting 8 other islands. Jean settled in to read from a very small volume of verse he'd tucked into his belt, while Bug continued practicing his coin manipulation, albeit with a copper piece that would look much less incongruous in public. Locke and the Sansa brothers talked shop with Vitale, whose job, in part, was to mark particularly lightly guarded or heavily loaded cargo barges for the attention of his fellows. On several occasions, he made hand signals to concealed watchers on shore, while the gentlemen bastards politely pretended not to notice. They drew close to Shades Hill. Even by day, those heights were steeped in gloom. By chance, the rain stiffened, and the old kingdom of tombs grew blurred behind a haze of mist. Vitale swung the boat to the right. Soon he was pushing them southward between Shades Hill and the Narrows, aided by the current of the seaward-flowing canal, now alive with the spreading ripples of raindrops. Traffic grew steadily thinner and less reputable on the canal as they sped south. They were passing from the open rule of the Duke of Camor to the private dominion of Kappa Barsavi. On the left, the forges of the coal-smoke district were sending up columns of blackness, mushrooming and thinning out beneath the press of the rain. The Duke's wind would push it all down over Ashfall, the most ill-looking island in the city, where gangs and squatters contended for space in the mouldering, smoke-darkened villas of an opulent age, now centuries past. A northbound barge moved past on their left, wafting forth the stench of old shit and new death. What looked to be an entire team of dead horses was lying in the barge, attended by half a dozen knackers. Some were slicing at the corpses with arm-length serrated blades, while others were frantically unrolling and adjusting blood-stained tarps beneath the rain. No Camorri could have asked for a more appropriate match for the sight and stink of the cauldron. If the dregs were poverty-racked, the snare disreputable, the Mara Camorazza openly dangerous, and Ashfall dirty and falling apart, the cauldron was all of these things with a compound interest of human desperation. It smelled something like a keg of bad beer overturned in a mortician's storage room on a hot summer day. Most of this district's dead never made it as far as the pauper's holes dug by convicts on the hills of the Beggar's Barrow. They were tipped into canals, or simply burned. No yellow jackets had dared enter the cauldron, save in platoons, even before the secret peace. No temples had been maintained here for 50 years or more. Barsavi's least sophisticated and restrained gangs ruled the cauldron's blocks. Brawlers' taverns and gays' dens and itinerant gambling circles were packed wall to wall with families crammed into rat holes. It was commonly held that 1 in 3 of Camor's right people were crammed into the cauldron, 1,000 wasters and cutthroats bickering endlessly and terrorizing their neighbors, accomplishing nothing and going nowhere. Locke had come out of Catchfire, Jean from the comfortable north corner. Carlo and Galdo had been dregs boys prior to their stay in Shades Hill. Only Bug had come out of the cauldron, and he had never once spoken of it, not in the 4 years he'd been a gentleman bastard. He was staring at it now, at the sagging docks and layered tenements, at the clothes flapping on washlines, soaking up water. The streets were brown with the unhealthy haze of sodden cookfires. Its flood walls were crumbling, its elderglass mostly buried in grime and piles of stone. Bug's coin had ceased to flow across his knuckles and stood still on the back of his left hand. A few minutes later, Locke was privately relieved to slip past the heart of the cauldron and reach the high, thin breakwater that marked the eastern edge of the wooden waste. Camor's maritime graveyard seemed positively cheerful by comparison once the boat had put the cauldron to its stern. A graveyard it was. A wide, sheltered bay, larger than the shifting market, filled with the bobbing, undulating wrecks of hundreds of ships and boats. They floated hull up and hull down, anchored as well as drifting freely, some merely rotting while others were torn open from collisions or catapult stones. A layer of smaller wooden debris floated on the water between the wrecks like scum on cold soup, ebbing and resurging with the tide. When false light fell, this junk would sometimes ripple with the unseen passage of creatures drawn in from Camor Bay, for while tall iron gates shuttered every major canal against intrusion, the wooden waste was open to the sea on its south side. At the heart of the waste floated a fat, dismasted hulk, 60 yards long and nearly half as wide, anchored firmly in place by chains leading down into the water, two at the bow and two at the stern. Camor had never built anything so heavy and ungainly. That vessel was one of the more optimistic products of the arsenals of distant Tal Vahrar, just as chains had told Locke many years before. Wide silk awnings now covered its high, flat castle decks. Beneath those canopies parties could be thrown that rivaled the pleasure pavilions of Jerem for their decadence. But at the moment the decks were clear of everything but the cloaked shapes of armed men, peering out through the rain. Locke could see at least 12 of them, standing in groups of 2 or 3 with longbows and crossbows at hand. There was human movement here and there throughout the waste. Some of the less damaged vessels housed families of squatters, and some of them were being openly used as observation points by more teams of hard-looking men. Vitali navigated through the twisting channels between larger wrecks, carefully making obvious hand gestures at the men on guard whenever the gondola passed them.
"Grey King got another one last night," he muttered, straining against his pole. "Lots of twitchy boys with big murder pieces keeping an eye on us right now, that's for damn sure."
"Another one?"
Carlo narrowed his eyes.
"We hadn't heard yet. Who got it?"
"Tall Tesso from the Full Crowns. They found him up in Rustwater, nailed to the wall of an old shop, balls cut off. His blood ran out, is what it looked like."
Locke and Jean exchanged a glance, and nervous Vitale grunted.
"Acquainted, were you?"
"After a fashion," said Locke. "And some time ago."
Locke pondered. Tesso was, had been, Garista of the Full Crowns, one of Barsavi's big earners, and a close friend of the Kappa's younger son, Pacero. Nobody in Camor should have been able to touch him, save only Barsavi and the spider, yet that damned invisible lunatic calling himself the Grey King had touched him in no uncertain terms.
"That's 6, said Jean, "isn't it?"
7, said Locke. "There haven't been this many dead gods damned Garistas since you and I were 5 years old."
"Heh," said Vitali. "And to think I once envied you, Lamora, even with this tiny little gang of yours."
Locke glared at him, willing the puzzle to come together in his head, and not quite succeeding. 7 gang leaders in 2 months, all of them given the distance, but otherwise having little in common. Locke had long taken comfort in his own lack of importance to the Kappa's affairs, but now he began to wonder. Might he be on someone's list? Did he have some unguessed value to Barsavi that the Grey King might want to end with a crossbow bolt? How many others were between him and that bolt?
Damn, said Jean, as if things needed to get more complicated.
Maybe we should take care of current business.
Galdo had shifted against the side of the gondola and was looking around as he spoke.
And then maybe we should get lost for a while. See Talvara or Talisham, or at least get you out, Locke.
Nonsense. Locke spat over the side of the boat. Sorry, Galdo. I know it seems like wisdom, but do the sums. The Kappa would never forgive our running out in his desperate hour. He'd rescind the distance and put us under the thumb of the most graceless, pig-hearted motherfucker he could find. We can't run as long as he stays. Hell, Nazca would break my knees with a mallet before anyone else did anything.
You have my sympathy, boys.
Vitale shifted his pole from hand to hand, using precise shoves to warp the gondola around a chunk of debris too large to ignore.
Canal work ain't easy, but at least nobody wants me dead for more than the usual reasons. Did you want me to leave you at the grave or at the quay?
We need to see Haza, said Locke.
Oh, he's sure to be in a rare mood today.
Vitale began poling hard for the northern edge of the waste, where a few stone docks jutted out before a row of shops and rooming houses.
The quay it is, then.
4. The pawn shop of No Hope Haza was one of the major landmarks of the reign of Kappa Barsavi. While there were many shops that paid slightly more, and a great many with less surly proprietors, there were no others located a bare stone's throw from the very seat of the Kappa's power. Right people, cashing in their creatively acquired loot with Haza, could be sure that their presence would be reported to Barsavi. It never hurt to reinforce the impression that one was an active, responsible thief.
Oh, of course,
said the old Vardran as Jean held the barred and armoured door open for the other four gentlemen bastards.
Figures only the least important garistas would dare show their faces on a day like this. Come in, my ill-looking sons of Komori bitches. Rub your oily therin fingers on my lovely merchandise. Drip water on my beautiful floors.
Haza's shop was always closed up like a coffin, rain or shine. Dusty canvas sheets were drawn over the narrow, barred windows, and the place smelled of silver polish, mildew, stale incense, and old sweat. Haza himself was a snow-skinned old man with wide, watery eyes. Every seam and wrinkle on his face seemed to be steadily sliding toward the ground, as though he'd been shaped by a slightly drunk god who'd pressed the mortal clay just a little too far down. No Hope had earned his moniker with his firm policy against extending credit or loaning coin. Carlo had once remarked that if he ever took an arrow in the skull, he'd sit around and wait for it to fall out on its own before he'd pay a physica for so much as a gauze scrap. In the right-hand corner of the shop, a burly, bored-looking young man with cheap brass on all of his fingers and greasy ringlets hanging in his eyes shifted his position on the tall wooden stool he occupied. An iron-studded club swung from a loop at his belt, and he nodded slowly at the visitors, unsmiling, as though they were too stupid to comprehend his function.
"Locke Lamora," said Haza. "Perfume bottles and ladies' small clothes, tableware and drinking goblets, scraped and dented metal I can't sell to anyone with any class ever again. You breakers and second-story boys think you're so clever. You'd steal shit from a dog's arsehole if you had the right sort of bag to bring it home with you."
"Funny you should say that, Hauser, because this bag here..." Locke plucked the burlap sack from Bug's hands and held it up. "Happens to contain..."
Something other than dog shit. I can hear it jingling. Give over and let's see if you accidentally brought in anything worth buying.
Haza's nostrils flared as he opened the sack and slid it along a leather pad atop his shop counter, gently spilling the contents. The appraisal of stolen goods seemed to be the only form of sensual gratification left to the old man, and he dove into the task with enthusiasm, long crooked fingers wiggling.
Crap!
He lifted the three lockets secured by Carlo and Galdo.
Fucking alchemical paste and river agates. Not fit for goat feed. 2 coppers apiece.
Harsh, said Locke.
Fair, said Haza. Yes or no?
7 coppers for all three.
2 times 3 is 6, said Haza. Say yes or go twist a shark's balls for all I care.
I suppose I'll say yes, then.
Haza perused the silver goblets Jean had selected from the bullshit box.
Dented, of course. You idiots never see a pretty silver thing you don't want to stuff inside a scratchy fucking bag. I suppose I can polish them and send them upriver. 1 solon, 3 coppers apiece.
1 solon, 4 per, said Locke.
3 solons, 1 copper total.
Fine.
And this?
Haza picked up the bottle of opium milk, unscrewed the cap, sniffed, grunted to himself, and sealed the vial once again.
Worth more than your life, but I can't hardly do much with it. Fussy bitches like to make their own or get an alchemist to do it for them. They never buy pre-mixed from strangers. Maybe I can pass it off on some poor fucker that needs a vacation from grapes or gays. 3 solons, 3 barons.
4 solons, 2.
The gods wouldn't get 4 and 2 from me. Morgante himself with a flaming sword and 10 naked virgins yanking at my breeches might get 4 solons, 1. You get 3 and 4, and that's final.
Fine. And only because we're in a hurry.
Haza was keeping a running total with a goose quill and a scrap of parchment. He ran his fingers over the small pile of cheap rings from Carlo and Galdo and laughed.
You can't be serious. This crap is as welcome as a pile of 7 dog cocks.
Oh, come on.
I could sell the dog cocks to the knackers, at least.
Haza flung the brass and copper rings at the gentleman bastards one by one.
I'm serious! Don't bring that crap around! I've got boxes on boxes of the fucking things I won't sell this side of death!
He came to the threaded gold and platinum ring with the diamond and obsidian chips.
This one signifies, at least, 5 solons flat. Gold's real, but the platinum's cheap Ferrari shit, genuine as a glass eye. And I crap bigger diamonds 5 or 6 times weekly.
7 and 3, said Locke. I went to pains to get that particular piece.
I have to pay extra because your arse and your brain switched places at birth? I think not. If that were the case, I'd have heard about it before. Take your 5 and consider yourself lucky.
I can assure you, Haza, that nobody who comes to this shop considers himself particularly...
And so it went. The apparently summary judgment, the two-way flow of abuse, the grudging assent from Locke, and the gnashing of the old man's remaining teeth when he took each item and set it down behind the counter. In short order, Haza was sweeping the last few things he had no interest in back into the burlap sack.
Well, sweetmeats, looks as though we're quits at 16 solons 5. I suppose it beats driving a shit wagon, doesn't it?
Or running a pawn shop, yes, said Locke.
"Very amusing,"
cried the old man as he counted out 16 tarnished silver coins and 5 smaller copper discs.
"I give you the legendary lost treasure of Camor. Grab your things and fuck off until next week, assuming the Grey King doesn't get you first."
5. The rain had faded back to a drizzle when they emerged from Haza's shop, giggling to themselves. "Chains used to claim that there's no freedom quite like the freedom of being constantly underestimated," said Locke.
"Gods, yes."
Carlo rolled his eyes and stuck out his tongue.
"If we were any freer, we'd float away into the sky and fly like the birds."
From the northern edge of the wooden waste, a long, high wooden bridge, wide enough for 2 people, ran straight out to the Kappa's waterbound fortress. There were 4 men on guard at the shore, standing around in the open with weapons clearly visible under their lightweight oil cloaks. Locke surmised there would be at least as many concealed nearby within easy crossbow shot. He made the month's proper hand signs as he approached with his gang behind him. Everyone here knew each other, but the formalities were non-negotiable, especially at a time like this.
"Hello, Lamora,"
the oldest man in the guard detail, a wiry old fellow with faded shark tattoos running up his neck and his cheeks all the way to his temples, reached out. They grasped left forearms.
"Heard about Tesso?"
"Yeah, hello yourself, Burnell. One of the grey faces told us on the way down. So it's true? Nailed up, balls, the whole bit?"
"Balls, the whole bit. You can imagine how the boss feels about it. Speaking of which, Nazca left orders. Just this morning. Next time you came by, she wanted to see you. Said not to let you pay your taxes until she'd had a word. You are here for taxes, right?"
Locke shook a little grey purse. Jean's 20 solons plus Harza's 16 and change.
"Here to do our civic duty, indeed."
"Good. Not passing many folks for any other reason. Look, I know you've got the distance and Nazca's a friend and all, but maybe you want to take it real easy today, right? Lots of peasant around. Obvious and not so obvious. Tight as it's ever been. Kappa's making inquiries with some of the full crowns right now, as regards their whereabouts last night."
"Inquiries?"
"In the grand old fashion. So mind your manners and don't make any sudden moves, right?"
"Savvy," said Locke. "Thanks for the warning."
"No trouble. Crossbow bolts cost money. Shame to waste them on the likes of you."
Burnell waved them through, and they strolled down the wooden walkway, which was about 100 yards long. It led to the stern of the wide, motionless vessel, where the timbers of the outer hull had been cut away and replaced with a pair of iron-reinforced witchwood doors. Another pair of guards stood here, one male and one female, the dark circles under their eyes plainly evident. The woman knocked 4 times at their approach, and the doors swung inward just a few seconds later. Stifling a yawn, the female guard leaned back against the outer wall and pulled the hood of her oil cloak up over her head. The dark clouds were sweeping in from the north, and the heat of the sun was starting to fade. The reception hall of the floating grave was nearly 4 times Locke's height, as the cramped horizontal decks of the old galleon had been torn out long ago, save for the upper castle and waste decks, which now served as roofs. The floor and walls were coffee-coloured hardwood. The bulkheads were hung with black and red tapestries on which shark's teeth border patterns were embroidered in gold and silver thread. A 6 bravos stood facing the gentleman bastards, crossbows levelled. These men and women wore leather bracers and leather doublets over silk tunics reinforced with light metal bands. Their necks were girded with stiff leather collars. A more genteel foyer would have been decorated with glow lamps and flower arrangements. The walls of this one held wicker baskets of crossbow quarrels and racks of spare blades.
"Ease up,"
said a young woman standing behind the gaggle of guards. I know they're suspicious as hell, but I don't see a Grey King among 'em. She wore men's breeches and a loose black silk blouse with billowing sleeves under a ribbed leather dueling harness that looked to have seen more use than storage. Her iron-shod boots, a taste she had never lost, clicked against the floor as she stepped between the sentries. Her welcoming smile didn't quite reach all the way to her eyes, which darted nervously behind the lenses of her plain, black-rimmed optics. "My apologies for the reception, loves," said Nazca Barsavi, addressing all the bastards but placing a hand on Locke's left shoulder. She was a full 2 inches taller than he was. "And I know it's cramped in here, but I need the four of you to wait around. Garistas only. Papa's in a mood." There was a muffled scream from behind the doors that led to the inner chambers of the floating grave, followed by the faint murmur of raised voices, shouts, cursing, another scream. Nazca rubbed her temples, pushed back a few stray curls of her black hair, and sighed. "He's making a vigorous case for full disclosure from some of the full crowns. He's got sage kindness in there with him."
13 gods, said Carlo. "We're happy to wait." "Indeed."
Galdo reached into his coat and pulled out a slightly soggy deck of playing cards.
"We can certainly keep ourselves entertained out here, indefinitely if need be."
At the sight of a Sansa brother offering cards, every guard in the room took a step back. Some of them visibly struggled with the idea of raising their crossbows again.
"Oh, not you bastards, too," said Galdo. "Look, those stories are all bullshit. Everyone else at that table was just having a very unlucky night."
Past the wide, heavy doors was a short passage, unguarded and empty. Nazca slid the foyer doors closed behind herself and Locke, then turned to him. She reached and slicked back his wet hair. The corners of her mouth were turned down. "Hello, Pezon. I see you haven't been eating."
"I eat regular meals."
"You should try eating for quantity as well as consistency. I believe I once mentioned that you looked like a skeleton."
"And I believe I'd never before seen a 7-year-old girl pushy drunk in public."
"Well, perhaps I was pushy drunk then, but today I'm just pushy. Papa's in a bad way, Locke. I wanted to see you before you saw him. He has some things he wishes to discuss with you. I want you to know that whatever he asks, I don't want you to, for my sake, well, please just agree. Please him. Do you understand?"
"No Garista who loves life has ever tried to do otherwise. You think I'm inclined to walk in on a day like today and deliberately twist his breeches? If your father says bark like a dog, I say, what breed, Your Honor?"
"I know. Forgive me. But my point is this. He's not himself. He's afraid now, Locke. Absolutely, genuinely afraid. He was morose when Mother died, but damn, now he's crying out in his sleep, taking wine and laudanum every day to keep his temper in check. Used to be I was the only one not allowed to leave the grave, but now he wants Anjace and Panchero to stay here, too. 50 guards on duty at all times. The Duke's life is more carefree. Papa and my brothers were up shouting about it all night."
"Well, look, I'm sorry, but I don't think I can help you with that. But just what is it you think he's going to ask me?"
Nazca stared at him, mouth half open as though she were preparing to speak. Then she seemed to think better of it, and her lips compressed back into a frown.
"Damn it, Nazca! I'd jump in the bay to try to blackjack a shark if you wanted, really! But you'd have to tell me how big it was and how hungry it was first. Savvy?"
"Yes. Look, I just... It'll be less awkward if he does it himself. Just remember what I said. Hear him. Please him. And you and I can sort things out later. If we get a later."
"What do you mean, if we get a later? Nazca, you're worrying me."
"This is it, Locke. This is the bad one.
The Grey King is finally getting to Papa. Tesso had 60 knives, any 10 of which were with him all the time. Tesso was deep into Papa's good graces. There were big plans for him in the near future, but Papa's had things his way for so long, I can't rightly say if he knows what to do about this. So he just wants to fold everything up and hide us here. Siege mentality.
Locke sighed. I can't say that what he's done so far is imprudent, Nazca. He's...
Papa's mad if he thinks he can just keep us all here, locked up in this fortress forever. He used to be at the last mistake half the nights of the week. He used to walk the docks, walk the Mara, walk the Narrows any time he pleased. He used to throw out coppers at the procession of the Shades. The Duke of Camor can lock himself in his privy and rule legitimately. The Copper of Camor cannot. He needs to be seen.
And risk assassination by the Grey King?
Look, I've been stuck inside this fucking wooden tub for 2 months, and I tell you, we're no safer here than we would be bathing naked at the dirtiest fountain in the darkest courtyard in the cauldron.
Nazca had folded her arms beneath her breast so tightly that her leather cuirass creaked.
Who is this Grey King? Where is he? Who are his men? We don't have a single idea, and yet this man reaches out and kills our people at leisure, however he sees fit. Something is wrong. He has resources we don't understand.
He's clever and he's lucky. Neither of those things lasts forever, trust me.
Not just clever and lucky, Locke. I agree there are limits to both. So what does he have up his sleeves? What does he know? Or who? If we are not betrayed, then it must be that we are overmatched. And I am reasonably certain that we are not yet betrayed.
Not yet?
Don't play stupid with me, Locke. Business could go on after a fashion with Papa and myself cooped up here. But if he won't let Andres and Panchero out to run the city, the whole regime will go to hell. The Garistas might think it prudent for some of the Barsavis to stay here. They'll think it cowardice for all of us to hide. And they won't just talk behind our backs. They'll actively court another Kappa. Maybe a pack of new Kappas. Or maybe the Grey King.
So naturally your brothers will never let him trap them here.
Depends on how mad and crazy the old man gets. But even if they stay free to roam, that's only the lesser part of the problem solved. We are again overmatched. 3,000 knives at our command, and the ghost still has the twist on us.
What do you suspect? Sorcery?
I suspect everything. They say the Grey King can kill a man with just a touch. They say that blades won't cut him. I suspect the gods themselves, and so my brothers think I'm crazy. When they look at the situation, all they see is a regular war. They think we can just outlast it, lock the old man and the baby sister up, and wait until we know where to hit back. But I don't see that. I see a cat with his paw over a mouse's tail. And if the cat's claws haven't come out yet, it's not because of anything the mouse has done. Don't you get it?
Nazca, I know you're agitated. I'll listen. I'm a stone. You can yell at me all you like.
But what can I do for you? I'm just a thief. I'm your father's littlest thief.
If there's a gang smaller than mine, I'll go play cards in a wolf shark's mouth.
I need you to start helping me calm Papa down, Locke. I need him back to something resembling his normal self, so I can get him to take my point seriously. That's why I'm asking you to go in there and take pains to please him, especially please him. Show him a loyal Garista who does whatever he's told, the moment he's told. When he starts to lay reasonable plans for the future again, I'll know he's coming back to a state of mind I can deal with.
Interesting, said Locke. And, daunting.
Papa used to say someday I'd appreciate having a gracious man to order around. Believe me, Locke, I do. So, here we are.
At the end of the short passage was another set of heavy wooden doors, nearly identical to the ones that led back to the reception hall. These doors, however, were barred and locked with an elaborate Ferrari clockwork device attached to crossbars of polished iron. A dozen keyholes were visible in the lockbox at the center of the doors. Nazca withdrew two keys that hung on a chain around her neck and briefly put her body between Locke and the doors so he couldn't see the apertures she chose. There was a cascading series of clicks and the noise of machinery within the doors. One by one, the hidden bolts unshot themselves, and the gleaming crossbars slid open until the doors finally cracked open in the middle. Another scream, loud and vivid, without the closed door to muffle it, sounded from the room beyond.
"It's worse than it sounds," said Nazca.
"I know what Sage does for your father, Nazca."
"Knowing's one thing. Usually Sage just does one or two at a time. Papa's got the bastard working wholesale today."
6.
"I've made it clear that I don't enjoy this," said Kappa Barsavi. "So why do you force me to persist?"
The dark-haired young man was secured to a wooden rack. He hung upside down with metal shackles around his legs, with arms tied downward at their maximum extension. The copper's heavy fist slammed into the prisoner's side just beneath his armpit. The sound was like a hammer slapping meat. Droplets of sweat flew, and the prisoner screamed, writhing against his restraints.
"Why do you insult me like this, Federico?"
Another punch to the same spot, with the heavy old man's first two knuckles cruelly extended.
"Why don't you even have the courtesy to give me a convincing lie?"
Kappa Barsavi lashed Federico's throat with the flat of one hand. The prisoner gasped for breath, snorting wetly as blood and spit and sweat ran down into his nose. The heart of the floating grave was something like an opulent ballroom with curving sides. Warm amber light came from glass globes suspended on silver chains. Stairs ran to overhead galleries, and from these galleries to the silk-canopied deck of the old hulk. A small raised platform against the far wall held the broad wooden chair from which Barsavi usually received visitors. The room was tastefully decorated in a restrained and regal fashion, and today it stank of fear and sweat and soiled breeches. The frame that held Federico folded downward from the ceiling. An entire semicircle of the things could be pulled down at need, for Barsavi occasionally did this sort of business in a volume that rewarded the standardization of procedures. 6 were now empty and spattered with blood. Only 2 still held prisoners. The Kappa looked up as Locke and Nazca entered. He nodded slightly and gestured for them to wait against the wall. Old Barsavi remained bullish, but he wore his years in plain view. He was rounder and softer now, his 3 braided grey beards backed by 3 wobbly chins. Dark circles cupped his eyes, and his cheeks were the unhealthy sort of red that came out of a bottle. Flushed with exertion, he had thrown off his overcoat and was working in his silk undertunic. Standing nearby with folded arms were Andres and Pachero Barsavi, Nazca's older brothers. Andres was like a miniature version of the Kappa, minus 30 years and 2 beards, while Panchero was more of a kind with Nazca, tall and slender and curly-haired. Both of the brothers wore optics, for whatever eye trouble the old Madame Barsavi had borne had been passed to all 3 of her surviving children. Leaning against the far wall were 2 women. They were not slender. Their bare, tanned arms were corded with muscle and crisscrossed with scars, and while they radiated an air of almost feral good health, they were well past the girlishness of early youth. Sherin and Raiza Barangias, identical twins, and the greatest contrarricala the city of Camor had ever known. Performing only as a pair, they had given the shifting revel almost 100 performances against sharks, devilfish, death lanterns, and other predators of the iron sea. For nearly 5 years they had been Kappa Barsavi's personal bodyguards and executioners. Their long, wild manes of smoke-black hair were tied back under nets of silver that jangled with shark's teeth. One tooth, it was said, for every man or woman the Barangius twins had killed in Barsavi's service. Last, but certainly not least alarming in this exclusive gathering, was Sage Kindness, a round-headed man of moderate height and middle years. His short-cropped hair was the butter yellow of certain Therin families from the westerly cities of Carthane and Lashane. His eyes always seemed to be wet with emotion, though his expression never changed. He was perhaps the most even-tempered man in Camor. He could pull fingernails with the mellow disinterest of a man polishing boots. Kappa Barsavi was a very capable torturer, but when he found himself stymied, the sage never disappointed him.
"He doesn't know anything!"
The last prisoner, as yet untouched, hollered at the top of his voice as Barsavi slapped Federica around some more.
"Kappa, Your Honor, please! None of us know anything! Gods, none of us remember!"
Barsavi stalked across the wooden floor and shut the second prisoner up by giving his windpipe a long, cruel squeeze.
"Were the questions addressed to you? Are you eager to get involved in the proceedings? You were quiet enough when I sent your other six friends down into the water. Why do you cry for this one?"
"Please,"
the man sobbed, sucking in air as Barsavi lightened his grip just enough to permit speech.
"Please, there's no point. You must believe us, Kappa Barsavi, please. We'd have told you anything you wanted if only we knew. We don't remember. We just don't..."
The Kappa silenced him with a vicious cuff across the face. For a moment, the only sound in the room was the frightened sobbing and gasping of the two prisoners.
"I must believe you? I must do nothing, Julien. You give me bullshit and tell me it's steamed beef? So many of you, and you can't even come up with a decent story. A serious attempt to lie would still piss me off, but I could understand it. Instead, you cry that you don't remember. You, the eight most powerful men in the Full Crowns, after Tesso himself. His chosen, his friends, his bodyguards, his loyal Pezon. And you cry like babies to me about how you don't remember where any of you were last night when Tesso just happened to die."
"But that's just how it is, Kappa Barsavi. Please, it's..."
"I ask you again, were you drinking last night?"
"No, not at all."